London Business School Review. Why truth is not enough. Facts shape our view of the world, but they can also grossly mislead, by Alex Edmonds.
The 2016 Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year was post-truth. Few would doubt that it was a deserved winner. In the Brexit referendum, the Leave campaign plastered buses with the claim that the UK sends £350 million a week to the EU, ignoring the rebate of £100 million plus the substantial sums that the EU spends on the UK. The US election campaign was similarly filled with falsehoods and candidates contradicting their own previous statements. But for every cloud, there's a silver lining. Psychologists refer to the importance of hitting bottom before recovery from an addiction. While 2016 might seem a low point, with falsehoods potentially swinging critical votes, the bright side is that the public now realises that it shouldn't accept everything at face value. Facebook and Twitter are taking seriously the concern that they may be platforms for fake news. And policymakers, journalists and bloggers are increasingly trying to back up their assertions with facts. Surely this is the perfect response to post-truth 2016. Not necessarily. In a recent TEDx talk entitled From Post-Truth to Pro-Truth, I explain why truth is not enough. Even if a fact is true, it may be meaningless. This is because a fact, even if true, may describe only a single isolated case and may not be representative of what normally happens. An anecdote is not data. You can almost always find an anecdote to support a view that you want to support. An anti-immigration newspaper could find one example of an immigrant family who committed a crime and turn that into a headline. A pro-immigration newspaper could find an example of an immigrant family who set up a business and created jobs and turn that into a headline. Both headlines may be true, but they are equally meaningless as they say nothing about immigrants in general. Digesting data. Stories are powerful. They're vivid. They bring ideas to life. It's stories, not statistics, that win headlines and make TED Talks and self-help books memorable. But a single story is meaningless and misleading if it is not backed up by large-scale data. While post-truth is the reigning Oxford Dictionary's word of the year, the biggest problem is not that we live in a post-truth world. It's that we live in a post-data world. We prefer a single story to tons of data. Why is data so derided? In addition to being boring, it is also seen to be the realm of experts. Just as 2016 saw the rise of post-truth politics, it saw the collapse of the expert. The low point was perhaps Brexit MP Michael Gove famously saying, "People in this country have had enough of experts." Experts are seen as out-of-touch elites. A multi-millionaire CEO warning about how Brexit would hinder free trade couldn't possibly speak up for the person on the street who cares about paying the mortgage, not free trade. But data challenges elitism. It provides the evidence against which an assertion can be tested. Without data, a CEO can simply say, "in my experience," which can't be shown to be false, and claim that his or her experiences are more valid than those of the individual on the street because these words of wisdom come from the lips of a CEO. Data is also democratic. It stands up for the person on the street and against the elites. In Roman times, censuses looked only at who was considered politically important, property-owning men. Data looks at the entire population and considers a CEO no more or less than anyone else. As Guardian journalist William Davis has written, "What characterized knowledge as statistical was its holistic nature. It aimed to produce a picture of the nation as a whole. Statistics would do for populations what cartography did for territory." Feel the quality. So, if a single true story isn't enough, surely it's enough to quote studies that use large-scale data. If these studies are by academics, all the better. Isn't that the best antidote to the denigration of the expert? Indeed, it's currently in vogue to follow a statement with something like C. Wiley Man 2015 to claim the mantle of academic rigour. But the use of academic evidence is also dangerous. There is an enormous range in the quality of evidence. the rigour of its methodology, its ability to distinguish causation from correlation, its power to control for extraneous factors. As a result, you can find evidence to support nearly any view you would like. Rather than evidence driving one's opinion, a preconceived opinion drives the search for evidence. This is the classic problem of confirmation bias. The public should not be impressed by a proposal being based on evidence without considering its quality. The Wileyman paper could be anything from a flawed unpublished draft to a Nobel Prize-winning article. In fact, Wileyman 2015 is an anti-vaccination study which has been widely discredited and has never been published. Quality of evidence is not just an academic debate where one academic snobbishly tries to claim that their paper is of higher quality than a rival's, but one with immense real-world implications. Three critical indicators of the quality of evidence often widely overlooked are whether the paper is published, where it is published, and who the authors are. A published paper has to go through rigorous peer review to check its scientific accuracy. Respected journals have the highest standards, using leading scholars at the world's best business schools to scrutinise manuscripts. As managing editor of the Review of Finance, Europe's leading finance journal, I reject 97% of manuscripts. The 3% not rejected are not immediately accepted either. Their status is revise and resubmit. The reviewers communicate concerns the authors need to address, and the paper can still be rejected at the next round. It is not unusual for a paper to take 5 years to be published after its first draft. A hard slog for the authors, but it helps ensure that the published results are correct. As an example of how rigorous checks can overturn a paper's conclusions, consider a witness's submission to the Parliamentary Inquiry on Corporate Governance. The witness argued for disclosure of pay ratios, citing a finding that firm productivity is negatively correlated with pay disparity between top executive and lower-level employees. The assertion was based on an unpublished 2010 draft. Having gone through peer review and after improving its methodology, the 2013 published version reversed the preliminary findings, concluding that firm value and operating performance both increase with relative pay. Besides highlighting the importance of peer review, this shows how a partisan observer can find any paper to support a preconceived view, even an unpublished draft, when a published version is available. The second indicator is the quality of the journal in which a paper has been published. That a journal calls itself peer-reviewed is far from sufficient to guarantee its rigour, since there is a vast range in the quality of reviewing standards. Journal quality can easily be checked by looking at one of the freely available lists, such as the Financial Times Top 50. Of course, every paper starts out unpublished. How do we gauge quality of a new one? The third indicator is the credentials of the authors, such as the quality of their institution and their track record of top-tier publications. Again, lists of the top universities are freely available. Last November, a study on executive pay hit UK national headlines, even though every single person I asked had not heard of the business school that released the study. This is not elitism, simply a desire to use the best evidence. We would listen more to a medical opinion from a world-famous hospital than one we hadn't heard of, and none of the newspapers covering the study had even read it. It was not out yet, but they were happy to take the author's word for it, perhaps because its findings played to the UK national mood on executive pay. Peer review is not perfect. Mistakes are made. But it is better to go with something checked than something unchecked. Anyone considering treatment options for a medical condition would want the world's best evidence on the treatment's success. We should apply the same rigour when considering the health of the economy.
Alex Edmonds is Professor of Finance at London Business School. For more fresh ideas from London Business School Review, visit london.edu/LBSR.